Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audible.com/thebrief and start listening today.
The European Union's highest court ruled Tuesday that an agreement that allows companies to freely transfer data to the U.S. is invalid as it does not adequately protect consumers. The verdict could have far-reaching implications for companies operating in Europe. It does not ban the transfer of data, but will allow national authorities to review what kinds of information companies want to send to the U.S., possibly implicating business. The ruling comes from a case that Austrian law student Max Schrems brought following revelations 2 years ago by former U.S. National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden about the NSA's surveillance programs. Schrems complained to the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland, where Facebook has its European headquarters, that U.S. law doesn't offer sufficient protection against surveillance of data transferred by the social media company to servers in the United States. Irish authorities initially rejected his complaint, pointing to a 2000 decision by the EU's Executive Commission that, under the so-called Safe Harbor Agreement, the U.S. ensures adequate data protection. The agreement has allowed for the free transfer of information by companies from the EU to the U.S. It has been seen as a boost to trade since, absent such a deal, swift and smooth data exchange over the Internet would be much more difficult. On Tuesday, the European Court of Justice ruled that the Data Sharing Pact is invalid. It said that the Safe Harbor deal enables interference by U.S. authorities with fundamental rights and contains no reference either to U.S. rules to limit any such interference or to effective legal protection against it. The court said the effect of the ruling is that the Irish Data Commissioner will now be required to examine Schrems' complaint with all due diligence. Once it has concluded its investigation, the authority must decide whether transfer of the data of Facebook's European subscribers to the United States should be suspended on the ground that that country does not afford an adequate level of protection of personal data, the court said in a summary of its ruling. Facebook said it couldn't immediately comment. Schrems said he hoped the ruling will be a milestone for online privacy. This decision is a major blow for U.S. global surveillance that heavily relies on private partners, Schrems said in a statement. The judgment makes it clear that U.S. businesses cannot simply aid U.S. espionage efforts in violation of European fundamental rights. However, he noted that the ruling doesn't bar data transfers from the EU to the U.S., but rather allows national data protection authorities to review individual transfers. Despite some alarmist comments, I don't think that we will see major disruptions in practice, Schrems said. Sophie Innert-Veld, a leading liberal lawmaker in the European Parliament, welcomed the ruling and called the Safe Harbor decision a travesty of legality. We need clear rules to govern the transfer of personal data to the U.S. and other non-EU countries, she said. But they must be legally watertight, provide real and meaningful protection, and there must be proper enforcement. This article posted by Pan Pilus of the Associated Press. Takaaki Kajita of Japan and Arthur MacDonald of Canada won the Nobel Prize in Physics on Tuesday for the discovery of neutrino oscillations. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences and the two researchers had made key contributions to experiments showing that neutrinos change identities. Neutrinos are particles that whiz through the universe at nearly the speed of light. They are created in nuclear reactions, such as in the sun and the stars, or in nuclear power plants. The discovery has changed our understanding of the innermost workings of matter and can prove crucial to our view of the universe, the Academy said. Kajita, 56, is director of the Institute for Cosmic Ray Research and professor at the University of Tokyo. MacDonald, 72, is a professor emeritus at Queen's University in Kingston, Canada. The winners will split the 8 million Swedish kroner, about $960,000 prize money. Each winner also gets a diploma and a gold medal at the prize ceremony on December 10th. On Monday, the Nobel Prize in Medicine went to scientists from Japan, the U.S., and China, who discovered drugs that are now used to fight malaria and other tropical diseases. The prize announcements continue with chemistry on Wednesday, literature on Thursday, the Nobel Peace Prize on Friday, and the Economics Award next Monday. This article posted by Carl Ritter and Malin Rising of the Associated Press. South Carolina was expecting sunshine Tuesday after days of inundation, but it will still take weeks for the state to return to normal after being pummeled by a historic rainstorm. Even as the rain tapered off, officials warned of the likelihood of new evacuations, such as one ordered Monday afternoon in one of two towns east of downtown Columbia, where two dams were breached. The governor warned communities downstream that a mass of water was working its way through waterways toward the low-lying coast, bringing the potential for more flooding and more displaced residents. "This is not over. Just because the rain stops does not mean that we are out of the woods," Governor Nikki Haley said Monday. South Carolina's geography and poor spending on infrastructure left several towns and cities like islands after roads washed out and creeks topped bridges. One of those cutoff communities was Manning, the county seat of Clarendon County, about 60 miles southeast of Columbia. "I fear the worst is to come. We have a power substation underwater. No telling when that thing gets fixed," Clarendon County Sheriff Randy Garrett said. At least 10 weather-related deaths in South Carolina and 2 in North Carolina were blamed on the vast rainstorm, including those of 5 people who drowned in their cars in Columbia alone. A solid week of rainfall also sent about 1,000 to shelters and left about 40,000 without drinkable water. Much-feared Hurricane Joaquin missed the East Coast, but fueled what experts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration called a fire hose of tropical moisture that aimed directly at the state. By Monday, the heaviest rains had moved into the mid-Atlantic states, but not before making history in South Carolina. The 16.6 inches of rain that fell at Gills Creek near downtown Columbia on Sunday made for one of the rainiest days recorded at a U.S. weather station in more than 16 years. John Shelton of the U.S. Geological Survey says flooding can be a concern for any urban area, with an abundance of concrete covering soil that would otherwise act as a sponge for excessive rains. But the multitude of waterways in Columbia also makes the city a prime target for flooding, as rainwater seeking to flow into a creek or river gets waylaid on the city's roadways. "The fact is that we're getting 6 months' worth of rain in 2 days that's falling in an urbanized area," Shelton said. This was kind of the perfect storm. The governor has said the deluge is the kind of storm seen only once in 1,000 years. The State Department of Transportation said nearly 500 roads and bridges were still closed Tuesday morning. Many of those were in the Columbia area. A 90-mile stretch of Interstate 95 was still closed between Interstates 20 and 26 due to flooding and overall poor road conditions. Officials warned residents not to try to drive through or around standing water and debris that have covered many roadways. Complicating the problem is that the infrastructure was already in bad shape in places. According to the American Society of Civil Engineers, 1,048 of the 9,275 bridges were structurally deficient before this storm. Power had been restored to thousands of residents. South Carolina Electric and Gas said less than 1,000 residents were without power early Tuesday morning. Duke Energy said only a handful of its customers were still waiting for electricity to come back on. The flooding forced hundreds of weekend rescues and threatened the drinking water supply for Columbia, with officials warning some could be without potable water for days because of water main breaks. The capital city told all 375,000 of its water customers to boil water before drinking. Officials brought in bottled water and portable restrooms for the 31,000 students at the University of South Carolina, and firefighters used a half dozen trucks and pumps to ferry hundreds of thousands of gallons of water to Palmetto Health Baptist Hospital. In another downstream area, Lake City, the flooding left a brown four-door sedan bobbing with its hood angled down at the road leading to Lake City High School, the site of a Red Cross shelter that housed more than 100 people Monday. Lisa Singletary, 34, trudged past the waterlogged car through water about 4 feet deep to reach the shelter after her sister's ground floor apartment was inundated. Singletary grabbed her three children, ages 1, 4, and 16, and her sister's three children, ages 9 to 18, and pushed through the grimy water after sunset Sunday, she said. She and her sister, Mary Singletary, then returned for everything they could carry. "We had to really wade in the water. We had to hold the kids up from really getting wet and everything," said Singletary, who was visiting for the weekend from nearby Johnsonville. The two women filled plastic trash bags with toothpaste, toothbrush, washcloths, towels, blankets, pillows, clothes, socks, shoes, Singletary said. "We brought everything that we could have brought." Back in the Columbia area, James Shirer saw the dam along Rockyford Lake in the town of Forest Acres fail Monday, causing the 22-acre lake to drain in 10 to 15 minutes. "It just poured out," Shirer said. "The lakes and ponds got so high, the dams couldn't take it anymore," Shirer said. Speaking of the rains, he said, "They've wrecked the dams. They've ruined all of the bridges. This one lake has already gone from topping over this bridge to where it's emptying out." As he spoke, water rushed through where the dam once was, and a military helicopter circled overhead. "It's devastating for Columbia," he said. "It's one of the worst things we've seen." This story posted by Jeffrey Collins and Emery P. D'Alessio of the Associated Press.
The mother of the man who killed 9 people and himself at Umpqua Community College in Oregon last week wrote extensively on social media about her love of guns and her difficulty raising an autistic child, the New York Times reports. Laurel Margaret Harper, mother of gunman Chris Harper Mercer, wrote that she kept AR-15 and AK-47 semi-automatic rifles and a Glock handgun in their home, and cited her son as her source on facts about gun laws. Writing on Yahoo Answers under the name Tweety Bird, she mocked lame states with tough gun control laws, and said that because of the multiple loaded guns she kept at home, no one will be dropping by my house uninvited without acknowledgement. She and her son would frequently go to shooting ranges, and she expressed disdain for inexperienced gun owners, writing that she would cringe every time the wannabes show up. Harper also acknowledged her son's troubled history and wrote that she and her son both had Asperger's syndrome, an autism spectrum disorder. She wrote that Chris, whom she never identifies by name, was, among other things, a headbanger, and seemed proud in what she and her son had accomplished despite their challenges. "I have Asperger's, and I didn't do so bad," she wrote. Elsewhere, she comforted another parent of a child on the autism spectrum, writing, "I was in your shoes, and now my son's in college." When advising other parents of kids on the autism spectrum, Harper recommended reading early and often to their children, and said that a particular favorite of hers was Donald Trump's bestseller, The Art of the Deal. Fact: before my son was ever born, I was reading out loud to him from Donald Trump's The Art of the Deal, she wrote. Police found 14 guns belonging to both Harper Mercer and his mother at their home after the shooting. Harper got divorced from her son's father, Ian Mercer, in 2006. Mercer told CNN he had no idea his son had access to so many guns, and that the massacre would not have happened had his son not been able to purchase so many firearms. "How is it so easy to get all these guns?" he asked. This article posted by Charlotte Alter. In America, the name Sachin Tendulkar may not ring a bell, but across much of the world, he's simply the god of cricket. In his native India and beyond, Tendulkar is the Michael Jordan, the Pele, the Wayne Gretzky of his sport, which just happens to be widely considered the second most popular in the globe. Since the 42-year-old retired from competitive cricket in 2013, he's been on a mission to further expand the game's imprint around the world. His next target? The United States. On October 6th, Tendulkar and fellow cricket legend Shane Warne of Australia will announce a 10-day, three-city cricket all-star exhibition tour of the United States in November in partnership with the U.S. sports marketing company Leverage Agency. Tendell Carr and Warren, who also retired from the game in 2013, will each captain a team consisting of some of the best international players of the past 35 years, in three matches scheduled to be played in U.S. baseball stadiums: New York City Field on November 7th, Houston's Minute Maid Park on November 11th, and Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles on November 14th. These exhibitions will feature the 2020 version of the sport, cricket matches that finish in a matter of hours rather than days. Pakistan's Wasim Akram, South Africa's Sean Pollock, Brian Lara of Trinidad and Tobago, and Mahela Jayawardene of Sri Lanka are among the other all-time greats slated to join the cricket barnstorming tour. Besides hoping to fill up ballparks, the players plan to conduct clinics in each stop to teach Americans about cricket. "You'll only learn things if you give them a try," Tendell Carr tells Time. "Americans are used to watching baseball, and it's very similar to that. If Americans can start coming to the stadium, I wouldn't be surprised to see them following cricket from here on." The U.S. has pockets of cricket passion in places like New York and Washington, D.C., particularly among immigrants from the West Indies and South Asia. Estimates have put America's cricket fan base at 15 million. "People are starving for a big cricket event like this," says Ben Sterner, CEO of Leverage Agency, which is producing the tour. State Farm is one of the sponsors. The company hopes to reach the U.S. South Asian audience, which has grown 81% between 2000 and 2010, according to the Asian American Federation. "We found cricket as a way to help us stand out," says Ed Gold, State Farm's advertising director. For cricket, the larger goal is to win new fans. In recent years, the traveling all-star strategy has been effective for soccer, another sport that had trouble gaining a U.S. foothold. Several top soccer clubs from Europe, like Manchester United and Barcelona, have played in the U.S., and the sport's popularity has grown. "America will be curious to see what it's like to experience the game of cricket," says Warren. "What's all the fuss about? Why is it the second most popular game in the world? What's so special about this game?" The tour's impact, Tendell Carr says, will be measured by how many it inspires. "I'm not looking forward to this trip, but to my next trip," he says. "I would like to see how many more people have picked up a cricket bat alongside a baseball bat, because that means we left an impression behind. That's something I want to do." This article posted by Sean Gregory.
Two major fantasy sports companies published statements Monday to combat allegations that employees had used insider information to win money on their sites. Fantasy sports is a largely unregulated industry in which fans populate their fictional team with real athletes, then bet on the outcomes using the athletes' performance in real life. Last week, an employee at DraftKings admitted to winning $350,000 at rival site FanDuel the same week he inadvertently disclosed DraftKings data before the start of the third week of football games, the New York Times reports. The offense is analogous to insider trading. The companies released a joint statement emphasizing the integrity of the service they offer their customers. Both companies have strong policies in place to ensure that employees do not misuse any information at their disposal and strictly limit access to company data to only those employees who require it to do their jobs, the statement reads. Employees with access to this data are rigorously monitored by internal fraud control teams, and we have no evidence that anyone has misused it. Although similar to gambling, fantasy sports sites are exempt from a 2006 federal law that outlawed online poker and other online games in many states, thanks to the argument that fantasy sports is a game of skill, not chance. This article posted by Charlotte Alter. Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the world's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. From current events to lectures, from histories to mysteries, Audible has the spoken word content you need to keep informed while your hands are busy, but your mind is free. Audible is now offering a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/thebrief, download a title free, and start listening. Reclaim your commute and discover something new. Get your free audiobook today by signing up at audible.com/thebrief.
Incursions into Turkey's airspace on Saturday and Sunday by Russian military Su-30 and Su-24 aircraft have been roundly condemned by NATO, which in a statement Monday called on Moscow to immediately explain these violations. Turkey's Ministry of Foreign Affairs has also summoned the Russian ambassador and warned that Russia will be responsible for any undesired incident that may occur in the event of further violations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry supported Turkey's apprehension. "We're greatly concerned," he said during a conference in Chile on Monday. "It is precisely the kind of thing that, had Turkey responded under its rights, could have resulted in a shootdown." For over a year, a U.S.-led coalition, which includes Turkey, has launched airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against the militant group Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria, ISIS. The group has run a campaign of ceaseless violence that includes mass executions, beheadings, rape, and the destruction of archaeological sites. Russia also claims to be targeting terrorist organizations with the airstrikes in Syria that it started launching on September 30th. But the West doubts these claims and has accused Moscow of instead bombing insurgents who have fought for 4 years to remove Russia's longtime ally, Syria's President Bashar Assad. NATO demanded Russia immediately cease its attacks on the Syrian opposition and civilians to focus its efforts on fighting ISIS. Far from fighting extremism, Kerry said Russia's actions guarantee much more terrorism, much more conflict, and possibly the complete destruction of the state of Syria. "The increasingly crowded battlefield has created a situation fraught with danger," UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric said during a daily press briefing on Monday. "I think this really should refocus people's attention on finding a political solution." This article posted by Mark Rivette Karnak. All Marty McFly wanted was a Pepsi, and now his wish is coming true. Later this month, PepsiCo is releasing a new limited edition bottle under the brand name Pepsi Perfect, emulating how the brand appeared when it was briefly featured in the 1989 film Back to the Future Part 2. In that film, a futuristic-looking Pepsi bottle is delivered to Michael J. Fox's character through a tube. The bottle is being sold as a collectible. In fact, only 6,500 bottles are being made, according to USA Today. Each bottle costs $20.15. Get it? Pepsi says the bottle is officially available on October 21st, the date McFly traveled into the future in the film. Promotions like this one are a way that big brands like Pepsi can have fun without major investments or strategy pivots. Just last week, Fortune reported on Miller Lite's plan to bring back the Steiny bottle, which features a stubbier neck than what beer drinkers are used to today. Short-term promotions featuring unusual bottling or can packages are a popular strategy for beverage companies. The promotion comes as Pepsi and other major soda companies face a steep challenge to turn around sales trends for carbonated soft drinks, which has suffered such a steep decline the past decade that volume has settled to levels last seen in the mid-1990s. Volume for Pepsi-Cola, for instance, slid 1.8% in 2014 in the U.S., according to industry tracker Beverage Digest. This article posted by John Kell of Fortune magazine. At least 9 people have died in flooding across South Carolina that has left city streets submerged in water, destroyed homes, and closed more than 100 bridges. Nikki Haley, the state's governor, described the disaster as one of such an epic scale that science suggests it would only occur once every 1,000 years. A flooding disaster of this scale was unlikely, to be sure, scientists say. But climate change has transformed once-in-a-lifetime events into periodic occurrences. The flooding may have been hard to predict, but it should no longer come as a surprise. The convergence of these statistically more likely events with what are very clearly climate-related changes in sea level is a cautionary perspective into the future, said Dana Beach, executive director of the state's Coastal Conservation League. It's one that we really have to pay a lot of attention to and not just write it off as something that isn't going to happen again. In South Carolina, a number of factors related to climate change, including sea level rise, high temperatures, and an unexpected hurricane, increased the likelihood that the state might experience widespread flooding. On top of that, an influx in hurricane-related rainfall and an already inundated water system combined to create a disaster. Melting ice on the polar ice caps and on glaciers due to global warming has caused sea levels to rise around the world. The effect varies depending on location, but South Carolina is far from removed from the problem. Water levels have already risen by a foot in Charleston over the past century, and conservative estimates suggest that sea levels off the coast of Charleston will rise by at least another 2 feet by 2100, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Water levels could increase much more dramatically without action to reduce global warming. A foot or two of higher sea levels may not sound like a lot, but at high tide or during a windy storm, a higher sea level makes it easier for water to be pushed ashore, a phenomenon called storm surge. Both high tides and windy storms related to Hurricane Joaquin were at play in recent days, according to Union of Concerned Scientists senior climate scientist Brenda Ekwerzel. Climate change also has the potential to increase the frequency of hurricanes, said Ekwerzel. Warming temperatures increases the level of water vapor in the atmosphere, which makes it easier for hurricanes to form, despite El Niño, which typically lowers the chance of an Atlantic hurricane. Combine all these factors with a water system that had already been overrun with water from other storms in recent weeks, and South Carolina faced a perfect storm. Beach describes the deadly flooding as something we've never seen before, but nonetheless says it illustrates the urgency of tackling climate change in his state. We just cannot afford to get bogged down in someone's ideological perspective of the world, he said. There's really not that much dispute in the need to act. Of course, the Palmetto State is far from the only place to face flooding in recent years. Time after time, from Hurricane Katrina in 2005 to flooding in Texas earlier this year, politicians and policymakers have expressed surprise at devastating floods. But climate scientists say that no matter how humans address and adapt to climate change, flooding will be a fact of life, and policymakers need to start preparing. We expect everywhere that flooding rains will increase, NOAA official Ken Kunkel said earlier this year. You can build it now for today's climate, but you may not be quite in tune to what the climate will be in 50 years. This article posted by Justin Worland.
As politicians, pundits, and popes are fond of reminding us, there is a large disparity in the distribution of wealth in the United States. What they don't mention is that there is also a geographic one. There are 12.3 million households that earn more than $150,000 a year, about three times the median household income in America. These households, which represent approximately the top 10% of earners, are heavily concentrated around the coasts and a few major landlocked cities. Time has produced an interactive map that visualizes this disparity by showing you how far you have to travel from any given county to encompass 100,000 of these rich households. You can either search for a city or county or click or tap it directly. In some cases, the count goes far above 100,000 if the final county to push the number of households over 100,000 is a very wealthy one. See more at time.com. This article posted by Chris Wilson.
A series of blasts has seriously damaged a hotel in the Yemeni city of Aden that was being used as the war-torn nation's seat of government, Al Jazeera reported. Officials with Yemen's government said that Tuesday morning's missile attack on El Qasr Hotel did not harm Khaled Baha, who is both the country's prime minister and its vice president, but claimed an unspecified number of casualties. It is unclear whether any government officials were killed. Authorities have not identified the perpetrators of the attack on the hotel, which has been an operations base for the government of Yemeni President Abed Rabu Mansour Hadi since he returned to the country in late September following a six-month exile in Saudi Arabia. Baha also returned from exile last month. Aden, a historic port city on Yemen's southern coast, was declared the country's provisional capital in July when an Arab military coalition successfully reclaimed the city from Shiite Houthi forces. Clashes between those loyal to the government and those who follow the Iran-backed Houthi insurgency have escalated in recent months. This article posted by Nash Jenkins.
A Botswanan cheetah who helped researchers understand hunting patterns was found dead on the side of the road in what Cheetah Conservation Botswana called an unnecessary and unprovoked attack. The cheetah, named Legolas after an elf in The Lord of the Rings, was found on the side of the highway with a shotgun cartridge nearby. In a Facebook post about his death, Cheetah Conservation Botswana says the location of the body indicates that Legolas was opportunistically killed and was unlikely to be causing a direct threat to livestock. The conservation group says it understands that sometimes farmers have to shoot to protect their livestock, but in this case, the cheetah's death was unprovoked and unnecessary. Instead, they are treating it as a poaching case. "We are very sad to inform you that one of our most beloved research cats, Legolas, has been shot and killed beside the A2 highway in the west of Botswana," Cheetah Conservation Botswana tweeted. "Legolas has been intensively studied by our team since 2014 and was one of the biggest cheetahs ever caught at a whopping 68.5 kilograms. Legolas and two of his three other coalition members were collared by CCB's research team in July 2014, and the data obtained from their state-of-the-art collars has revolutionized the study of cheetahs' collaborative hunting techniques, which until now had been largely unknown. The fact that his body was discovered on the side of the highway along with the shotgun cartridge indicates that Legolas was opportunistically killed and was unlikely to be causing a direct threat to livestock. CCB staff are devastated by this news. We at CCB have always sympathized with the farmers who have problems with predators, but this unprovoked attack is really unnecessary. Considering the declining populations of cheetahs in Africa, the death of any cheetah is concerning, but the loss of such an iconic, record-breaking cheetah who contributed so much to the knowledge of this species is truly devastating. Because he was killed on public land, shot in an area devoid of livestock, and his body abandoned rather than delivered to wildlife authorities as required, this killing qualifies as a poaching case and is being investigated accordingly. Our entire team and those who were lucky enough to have worked and studied this magnificent animal are all in mourning in the wake of this needless attack. Of the seven cheetahs that were collared in the research project last July, three have been confirmed to have been shot. Considering that the number of cheetahs being shot is likely to be much higher than reported, the rates of offtake are of great concern. Legolas's death has been heartbreaking for the CCB team, but it has also reinforced our need to continue to fight to save this threatened species. Clearly, there is still a lot of work that needs to be done. Legolas was one of the biggest cheetahs ever caught, according to CCB, and he has been fitted with a specialized collar so that researchers can investigate how he hunted with his fellow cheetahs. That research contributed to new knowledge about how cheetahs hunt collaboratively. But since the research project started last July, three of the seven cheetahs involved have been shot. The death comes just a few weeks after the death of Cecil the Lion, who was killed by an American dentist this summer, sparking international outrage. This article posted by Charlotte Alter.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.